we've had a lot of transitions, and with that comes a lot of questions and a lot of dynamics trying to navigate with, you know, the new clients and their homes and trying to figure out how to do some problem solving. There's always a lot of problem solving with new placements.
Okay, so this fall, we're rolling right off a certification. I think one of the important pieces that gets missed during certification and leading up to certification is there's still referrals and there's still kids that need homes, adults that need placement. Give me an update just kind of over the past couple of months. What's that been looking like in the referral and placement world?
Well, the world did not stop during survey, which was kind of, I think, always a big shocker because we're so busy in the field trying to make sure that we are top notch. But business keeps on going. And so we had a ton of referrals during certification this year and a ton of great referrals. I think this quarter is going to be the best quarter we've had this year. We lose clients and then, of course, we bring new ones in. But they're with all of the craziness that was going on, we just kept moving the entire time. A lot of our program managers were dealing with, you know, current homes and trying to make sure everything was tip top in the field. And then also navigating new clients and trying to learn about them and getting the home situated and providing that reassurance and all of those supports when you get a new client. We killed it this year. Like, we did a really, really great job of being able to navigate both of those things.
Good. I'm Stacey Owen with The Hopeful Connection, and I'm sitting down with Amber Johnson to talk about placements and referrals within Restoring Hope. So welcome, Amber.
Hi.
Okay. So just catch me up a little bit on what's been going on with referrals within Restoring Hope.
So we had a lot of unique referrals this quarter. We have been working with Children's Division on bringing some clients from out-of-state placement. That's been really neat, something different. We did do one last year, but it was just kind of, you know, putting our toes in the water. But this quarter, we went all in. And so there's three kiddos from Missouri that have been getting treatment in another state that get to come back home to Missouri. And that's been really exciting, having to work with an out-of-state provider with Children's Division and coordinating all of the elements you don't typically deal with in a transition has been really exciting. A huge learning process, but it goes to show how amazing our program management and our homes are to be able to navigate. It's scary to get a new client, but they're getting clients that they have not met in person. And so I think that it goes to show what a great support we give to our homes for them to trust us enough to even attempt that.
Sure. So I know that's something you've been really excited about over the past couple of months, and I have missed out on being as involved as I would like to be in that because of other things that have been going on within the agency. So tell me a little bit more about how it elevated to the point that we have so many kids out of state receiving services, and what are the dynamics to get them back to the state that they can be then receiving services within Missouri?
So we struggle, especially with the children that qualify for our services. You know, there is a struggle to get them the medical care, psychiatric care that they truly need. There's very limited places that will provide treatment to, we'll say, a kiddo who's nonverbal with autism, whose IQ is under 70, or they wouldn't be able to participate in group therapies. And so hospitals have to turn them away because they don't have the staffing or the system to really treat them. And so Children's Division has these kiddos who need those supports. And so they've had to look outside of Missouri. So they're utilizing places in like Louisiana and Arkansas and particularly a hospital system in Texas, which is where the kiddos that we're taking are coming from. So it's unfortunate. Like, we want to keep Missouri kids in Missouri, but there's not the facilities there to support them. We struggle with that with hospitalizations for the kiddos that we support right now, and there's just nowhere for them to go. There's a hospital or two that are starting to kind of dive into the neuroscience part of psychiatric treatment. But in Texas, the hospital system that Children's Division is utilizing, like, that's their specialty. So it's TBIs, personality disorders, Prader-Willi, things like that, that there's not treatment for right here at home.
Mm-hmm. I know we've even seen that on the acute stays that, you know, an individual is escalated. They need to meet that criteria for inpatient. And we've seen facilities in Kansas, Illinois, Arkansas, and Tennessee all been used, mm-hmm. even on those short-term stays. So I can imagine those longer-term intensive placements are even more challenging to find in Missouri.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that goes into it. And when you look at an acute stay, you know, when you're in the moment and it's a crisis and you're like, I need this kiddo to go to a hospital, they need help, they're hurting themselves, or, you know, self-harm, you know, banging their head or whatever it is that's going on, I need help for them. And then you call, you know, 5 or 10 hospitals and they're like, mm-hmm. well, what's their IQ? And you're like, it's under 70. And like, we can't help you. And, you know, it's really frustrating because, you know, they need treatment. They need help just like anybody else. And there's not a place to do that here.
Yeah. So transitioning away from the placements that we're currently working on or that you're currently working on, let's talk about just your time at Restoring Hope. How long have you been here and what have you seen really change in the years that you have been here?
So I started here in 2017. I think I've been here 8.5 years. So when I started, we could sit at a table, like a lunch table, you know, like in school. Mm-hmm. Our team could sit around that, and it was small. I think we supported 60 clients when I started. And I mean, we've grown, hundreds of percents at this point, but we're up to over 300 clients. And in that time, you know, we've learned a lot. There's been a lot of transitions that were done perfectly, and there were some that were not done perfectly, but all we've done is learn and make our systems better as we continue to grow. The most exciting aspect of it is from when I started is the amount of relationships we've built in the industry so that, you know, we get that phone call. It's not just, you know, looking on the database anymore. It's a phone call from, you know, somebody with Children's Division that's like, hey, you guys helped with, you know, this kiddo and this one is so similar, you know, can you help us? And being able to say, yeah, I can help you, like, that's super rewarding. And over the years, it's grown and grown to where those connections are a lot stronger. And being able to have those relationships with people, it's been really neat. It's so different than when we started, but we're still doing the same work, but on such a bigger scale now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talking about placement specifically, if I'm a home, and I think we get asked this so frequently with, you know, homes that are transitioning into the onboarding process through Restoring Hope. What does the placement process look like for a home?
So there's the perfect placement process, and we can talk about what that looks like. And, you know, we get a referral from an outside source, support coordinator, Children's Division, a guardian. We get the referral. We'll look it over. We have, you know, several people in our placement team. We might even all look it over to, you know, to come up with an idea on if we need to look across regions and things like that. Then we determine at that point by talking to the team and looking over the paperwork if we want to meet them. We try to meet all of the referrals. So, you know, it's nothing to drive to St. Louis this week and Kansas City twice next week, you know, to meet people. But, you know, a lot of the placement process is intuition, because when you're dealing with a human with developmental disabilities or with mental illness, you're just dealing with one person with mental illness and disabilities. They're all very different. So going and being able to meet them in person and seeing who they are, it makes a world of difference. And I feel like if I'm going to ask a home to go and meet them, then I need to be able to go and meet them as well. So it's kind of the initial screening process. And then after that, we will look at the homes that we have that are available. it's not on a wait list type process, you know, like you're the third, so you get the next, you know, the third client's yours. It doesn't work like that. We have to look at a lot of different factors. Who's living in the home, what experience you have, can that client be around other children, around pets, where their trauma came from, like should they have a female caregiver or a male caregiver? There's a lot that goes into it, aside from just what region of the state can we place them in. And so we limit, we look at that and then we kind of, you know, limit the number of homes that we reach out to. We send out that information. And at that point, if the home is interested in meeting them, we set that up to where they can go meet them in person as well. So, paperwork, it's just words on a paper. When you meet somebody in real life, you get a whole different perspective of who they are. One thing I like to tell the homes is, you know, like if somebody wrote down, my worst day and put it on paper and handed it to you to read that, you would be like, whoa, who is this person? Like, I don't want to be friends with them. Like, I don't want to work with them. But that was just my worst day. And with the people we support, that's really what is being documented. They want to know what the very worst day is for them. Which makes sense, you know, for support reasons and things like that, but there's still a person there and that person might've been going through something really bad at that time. So, we want the homes to go meet them and have a face to that paperwork. And if at that point they decide that it could be a good fit, we like to do a pre-placement visit and then go back to the team and let the team make that decision. And I would love to get to make those decisions, but I'm not the guardian. The guardian and the team are the ones we all work together to determine who the best fit is after that point. After it's been decided, it could be anywhere from a couple days to a couple months before the placement occurs. Mm-hmm. And that really just depends on if they're Children's Division or Department of Mental Health. Do they already have a waiver? Those kinds of things. So there's all of that. And that's like, you know, the typical way it works. But there's also emergency placements mm-hmm. where I could call and be like, hey, do you have an opening right now? And this is the information that we have. They've just been removed from the, you know, natural family's home and they need a place to sleep tonight. They're going to be sleeping in the CD office. And those ones are risky. And we're asking a family to take a risk on somebody they've never met. But some of the best clients that we have came from an emergency placement.
Right. So I want to go back to a couple of the points that you made with the individuals, you know, you referred to, you know, if you've met one individual, you know, with a developmental disability or mental health issues, you've met one individual. I feel like that's the same with the placement process. So you may have went through the placement process once, but you've really only went through it once because mm-hmm. I know the placement team does a really good job as far as to have our process, but it feels like the process is rarely followed in the order that it's supposed to be, you know, whether it's that emergency placement, whether it is the home doesn't want a ton of options or they do want more options. So I feel like for homes, it definitely can feel the placement process can feel very different every time they go through it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think that we'll do some of our homes that have been with us for a really long time, they've had several placements. And I think that they're so great because they're so good at just winging it because they know that, you know, it might look this way this time and different the next time. So there definitely has to be some flexibility in being a host home, especially if you want a placement sooner rather than later, because things don't always follow a typical process. It doesn't follow a beautiful line, even though we want it to. It doesn't.
Yeah. So one of the things that I tell everyone, whether it's managers, business office, new host homes, people that are wanting referrals, that meeting an individual where they're at is the absolute best part about restoring hope. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your experience when you get those referrals and you're able to really go meet that kid where they're at. How does that set up the referral process and ultimately the success for that individual?
I think the investment level is so much stronger when you've seen them from the very beginning. There's there's clients that we have with us that when I went and met them at their residential facility mm-hmm. or in their natural home, you know, it is heartbreaking. Kiddos with broken limbs sitting at a hospital where staff had abused them, or it's on the news. A situation is like, you mm-hmm. know, the night before their parent was arrested for what happened, and here they are in our care. And it makes me, like, I know me personally, I'm so invested, and I want to do everything I can to keep them for as long as possible. Because we are the best placement that they've ever had, mm-hmm. the best relationships that they've ever had. I feel like every program manager should go and meet clients before they're placed, even if we don't accept them, just so they can see the different variety of people that we meet. Because when you see them, you know, in the most vulnerable state, like that is literally for them leaving their home, leaving their families, you know, those situations, like that is their most vulnerable moment. And to watch them grow and see them with a family, you know, a year later, like there is nothing more rewarding than that. And I joke around and I say that I have the best job at restoring mm-hmm. hope. Like I still stand on that. I have the best job with restoring hope.
Yeah. And I think when you go meet somebody, whether it's at a CD office because they've recently been removed, or a full-time caregiver and family member has passed away that's always mm-hmm. cared for them, or in a residential facility where they, you know, meet the criteria at this point to get out, I think that you see them at their worst mm-hmm. And you have the ability to then follow their progression with a family and with the supports to be able to go up from there. And I know I have so many names that are going through my mm-hmm. head as far as you meet them at that place. And then, you know, 6 months or a year later, you see them at a Restoring Hope event, or you see pictures of them at different vacations, and they're unrecognizable mm-hmm. because of the love and care and support that they've received from our homes has now transformed their whole life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And we look at, it's easier to see, honestly, like trauma when it comes to like the children, like they're being mm-hmm. removed from natural homes, or they were in a residential facility that's being shut down due to allegations. You know, we see that and we're like, oh, that's so traumatic. But we also are having this influx, I feel like, in the last few years of aging families mm-hmm. who can no longer care for their child. And how traumatic is that? Like this, you know, individuals lived with their family, you know, 45 years, and now mom and dad are too old, or mom and dad have passed away, and we're removing them from the only family they've ever known and trying to give them a new family. And so the trauma, you know, we don't compare traumas. Trauma is trauma and affects everybody uniquely, mm-hmm. but we're seeing, you know, this a different kind of trauma now in trying to replace or add to family, for individuals who really had a wonderful life. Yeah. And how can you, you know, you have to live up to getting to live with your mom and dad mm-hmm. until you're 45 and trying to find a family that can fill that same void. So it's interesting because we have it kind of the spectrum of who we support now is so big and where they're coming from is so big.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point as far as with some of our individuals that are older through DMH that they have lived without services for a long time, and they have lived at home. And then, you know, honestly, with age expectancies and modern medicine and all of that, that has mm-hmm. definitely pushed individuals to a higher life expectancy, depending on disabilities. But same for caregivers. But it becomes a point that we have a lot of natural families that are not able to provide that level of support anymore, which is great, but those transitions can be equally as challenging mm-hmm. To help our individuals navigate.
Yeah. And I think just being very open-minded, if you want to be a host home or a program manager, or even in our business office, to be fully aware that, you know, the people that we support have those elements of trauma, whether it's, you know, from the fact that they were involved in something criminal to they were just taken from the only mom and dad mm-hmm. they've ever known. And so being trauma informed and knowing that everybody comes with that story or with a story is super important. And if you lose sight of that, then you lose sight of the person. And, you know, they're not numbers. They're all people and that deserve homes and family and supports and relationships. And knowing where they come from is a vital piece of that.
Yeah. So you've talked a little bit about the placement process and the system and process that you guys use. I know, just being a little bit on the outside of it, you guys don't always hear the feedback of how successful it is. I know recently I had went back through some individuals we supported and some names, and connected with different families, and the placement process is so vital to the success of our individuals, our families, and Restoring Hope. So I'll give you a statistic, and it still is mind-blowing to me because of the amount of individuals we take on an emergency basis. Mm-hmm. But we support around 150, 175 children's division kiddos in residential services. And we have not given notice on a children's division kid in almost 2 years. Does that surprise you? What do you contribute that to?
It's surprising for sure, mm-hmm. because, you know, we have such a variety of clients that we support, but I'm also not surprised at the same time, because we have, great systems, first of all, and such great communication. So like when a client isn't doing well with us, like how amazing is it that the team can get on board and say, you know what, this may not be the best fit. Let's look at something, whether it's a different home or different services or even a different agency, that we're not having to give notice on clients. I think that's amazing. And it goes to show the hard work that's going on in the field and the hard work that's going on behind closed doors in those homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and like I mentioned, as far as like the emergency placements, and you referred to it earlier, as far as, you know, here's the placement process, and then emergency placements are totally different. It's the calls at 4:30 on a Friday going into a holiday weekend from a children's division worker that says, hey, we have this kid, he's sleeping in our office if we can't find a home for him. So explain the emergency placement process, because I know it feels like it's not the norm, but then it absolutely becomes the norm, and we'll have 8 or 10 of them in 1 month that, you know, we receive. So what does that process look like when we get one of those calls?
So, like you mentioned, it's going to vary. But I feel like, it always starts with that phone call, and the phone call is typically at the very end of the day on a Friday. It feels like, we get the phone call, and honestly, it's a lot of it is, the trust we have with our RCSTs, with children's division, the fact that they know what type of kiddos should be in a host home. And so when they call us, they already have like a little bit of a feeling like that maybe we can help them. So we take that phone call and we connect with the team. So the children's division worker, emergency placements, the majority of the time, even the CD worker, might have very limited information on that kiddo, because it could be they were taken from their natural home that day. So we go through what we do know, even if it's very little. We talk about dynamics, like what would be good for that kiddo. So we know, like, if they're, you know, nonverbal, that we need to have a home that really specializes in that. And I mean, we do have homes that specialize in certain types of clients that they do really well with, you know, females or nonverbal children or teenage boys. Like, they all have like kind of their niche. But we go through and we talk about what we do know, and then take that information, and it can be a frantic phone call. And I, you know, we have some homes that are always willing to help in an emergency, and they're a godsend. And so we are so lucky to have those homes, and we can call them and we can say, hey, we have this situation. What do you think? Sometimes we have homes that'll be like, you know what, I'm full, but you know, like I know this home and they would do really great with them. And so then we'll call that home and get an idea. But we typically have like a good idea in our head on what type of home would be good. And then we reach out to those people. And sometimes we'll take them and we'll say, let's just try it for the weekend. Mm-hmm. Like, can we keep this kid out of the CD office for the weekend? And then at that point, the home will try it out. And, you know, honestly, most of the time they never leave that home. And we got it right the first time, which is amazing. And they get to stay there. And sometimes, you know, that home can help identify the specific supports that kiddo needs, and we can get them into a different home. So an emergency placement literally can happen within a matter of a couple hours between phone call and we have a kid heading to a new host home. And the great thing is when you help outer agencies like Children's Division in a moment like that, you know, we have to remember, like, they have families too. And when they're sleeping in the office all mm-hmm. weekend long, or they've been in the office for 4 days and they can't find placement, you know, we're helping them out. And in turn that, it, you know, we're building that relationship with them. And then we have homes that get forever family members at the drop of a hat. So mm-hmm. I would love to say that it follows any kind of procedure or any kind of, you know, process, but it really is just kind of crazy. And the great thing is, like, I love that. Mm-hmm. I love the crazy of an emergency placement. Like, give me five. Like, I'm always ready for those. But I think they're really rewarding too, because they're fast paced, they're kind of frantic. And a lot of those we have to work really hard in the beginning, and then the payoff is even bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. So for families that are maybe caregiving is new to them or host homes are new to them, I know one of the things that when I was doing placement many, many years ago, I would reference, like, when you take an individual, you may think that you're prepared because you've done the trainings, you have prepped your family, you've prepped the space, and then you actually take the placement. Mm-hmm. I always referred to it as no different than when you have a baby and you bring a baby home from the hospital. You think you're ready, and then now you have this new baby that you're solely responsible for, and you have no idea what you're doing, and it's not going well. I refer to that very similar to our placement process. Mm-hmm. It takes a period of time to adjust and become successful. What are those conversations looking like with new homes to prepare them and to maybe get them through some of that initial, this is normal type thing mm-hmm. with placements?
I think that as much as we talk about, you know, the honeymoon period with our clients, there's a honeymoon period for everybody. That's the way it works with any new relationship. Sometimes the honeymoon wears off really quickly and we're like, oh gosh, like, what did we get into? But I think that it's really important for our host homes and our program management, all of us, to remember that our clients are coming to us with a bag of tools that have worked for them. So when they go into a new home and they're screaming, or maybe they are sneaking food, or, you know, whatever the behaviors are that are so aggravating or hard to handle in the moment, like, all of those behaviors are a story. So we see a kid who's sneaking food, but in all reality, little Joey had food withheld from him or did not have access to food. Or we see a teen boy that refuses to do anything but lay in bed and doesn't want to go to day program or go to school. But in all reality, that behavior is a story of somebody who was criticized really harshly for making mistakes or didn't do well in school mm-hmm. Before coming to us. And so when we get new clients and we see these behaviors, to remember that the behaviors are all connected to a story, which kind of goes back to what you had mentioned earlier about seeing them from, you know, when we first got them, like, where they came from. If you understand that, then it's a lot easier to navigate all of those new things when they do get there to the home. And for the host home to know that sometimes we don't know the story mm-hmm. and sometimes it's a mystery, and we get to try to solve the mystery together to find out where that behavior is coming from. But everybody has behaviors, clients, homes, neurotypical, developmentally disabled, everybody has behaviors, and it's trying to find out the actual root cause of it. And if they didn't need those supports, we would not have them to support them. Mm-hmm. And so there's no such thing as a perfect host home, and there's no such thing as a perfect client. And but we do have some pretty perfect humans that we get to deal mm-hmm. with, and we just have to figure out how to best support them. But it would be, it is very rare that even the easiest client doesn't have some challenges that the host home has to navigate.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that some of those challenges show up on day one, and some of those mm-hmm. challenges can show up in year three or four.
Yes.
It just depends on what those challenges are. And so with new placements and the challenges that we see, what is your advice to new homes? They have this new individual in their home. What is your advice for them? Because I know we talk about the individual a lot. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have specifically for the home to be able to get through that challenging season until everyone's more comfortable and, you know, a routine's established?
I would say definitely lean on your support team. So your Restoring Hope support team, they, you know, for the most part, our program managers are pretty seasoned. They've been in the mm-hmm. field in some aspect or another, and they could, you know, before coming to Restoring Hope, and then several have been here several years. So be able to use them as a resource, I think, is very important. But also know that it's okay to not be perfect. Like, it is okay for there to be hard days, and there it is okay for there to be days where you're like, I feel like I didn't succeed at all today. That, you know, today was just mm-hmm. full of those behaviors or full of tears. I'm sure there's mm-hmm. lots of days full of tears, and that's okay, because just like bringing home your own baby, like, you have to figure that other human out, and it takes time to do that. We don't expect perfection. Like, we expect homes that have the heart and the dedication to those individuals. And like I always say, if you have the heart to do this job, we'll teach you the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is so true. Like, regardless of the type of individual, if you can open up your home and open up your heart to that person, we can teach you how to do all of the other stuff. And the days do get easier. Mm-hmm. And then you might have another hard day thrown in there from time to time. But, you know, that's why we're here too, is to help you help them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, one of the pieces that we do through the onboarding is the home study, and that really gives the homes an opportunity to speak to how their home is set up, who's mm-hmm. in their home, the interests of their home, logistics, everything about this specific home. And we really utilize that for the placement process. But I think that another place that we really lean on that is through the relief process. Mm-hmm. And so what advice do you have, or what have you seen for new homes in either trying to get their feet wet by doing relief or, you know, exploring the type of individuals they would want to support through the relief process?
Do relief. Do lots of relief. When you're waiting to get a full-time client, you could have worked at a school or an ISL or, you know, a group home, wherever you were before becoming a host home. It is different to have them in your home. So I 100% do relief, do respite. If you don't have another individual in your home that you're supporting, do respite. And really the reason for that is you have an idea of what you think will fit into the dynamic of your home. And then after you've been doing relief or respite, you can see that maybe your options or your criteria for a client might become more broad instead of being so narrow. We have a program manager that works with us that also does relief. And when she first started, she said, I only want to deal with adults. I don't want to deal with kids. Kids are a lot of work. And so she did some relief, and now she's like, I only want to do relief for kids. Kids mm-hmm. are so much easier. So I think it depends. And then also to realize too, if you think that, you know, you're only interested in a 12-year-old little girl, that, you know, maybe there's certain individuals that are in their 30s that, you know, female who's in her 30s that you're like, oh wow, I really enjoyed supporting them too. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of opens your mind up a little bit to the potential of different types of clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point, because I know I see the families that when they came to Restoring Hope, for whatever reason, brought them, you know, to our path of Restoring Hope. They came in with the expectations of, you know, I'm going to support a specific person, or I want to support children, or I only want to support adults. And then they built relationships with individuals either through like Restoring Hope parties or mm-hmm. through Relief, you know, through other Restoring Hope families. And then, you know, years later after being here, they support people way different than what they thought they were going to initially. And so I think, you know, being open to that and going through the process of Relief and Respite definitely gives families a better idea of individuals that do fit best mm-hmm. into their family dynamics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, once you go through and you realize the similarities with humans, depend, like, it doesn't really matter the age in a lot of mm-hmm. situations. You know, sometimes, you know, you have an individual who at 12 years old was a certain way, and now they're 22 years old and developmentally they're still the same as they were when they were 12. Mm-hmm. And so they're bigger, obviously, but mm-hmm. I think that otherwise over time it becomes more evident that age may not be the only qualifying factor in supporting an individual.
Yep. Good point. Okay, so you've been doing placements a long time. Without using names and families, like, what is your one placement that just absolutely sticks out to you?
Oh, gosh. Oh, there's so many. One that I just can't get past, like, one that I think about a lot is, teen boys are hard. We mm-hmm. have a lot, and we have a lot of teen boys at Restoring Hope. But typically, you know, I read a plans for a teen boy and it's very quick that I'm like, nope, like, we can't do that here. Like, they need a higher level of care. But we had one that was an emergency placement in St. Louis, and I had received the plan and I was like, I don't think we can support them. I think they need a higher level of care. Maybe too behavioral. I was just really, really nervous about it. And we get out there, and there was several clients that we placed through the situation, and kind of a last minute decision. We went and met this kiddo, and I instantly was like, I can't believe it. I almost said no. Mm-hmm. And it was such a strong feeling that I was like, well, let's get in my car. You're going back to Sedalia with me. And so he got in the car and we stopped at Taco Bell, and then we made our way to Sedalia and gave him a host home, and it wasn't planned at all. And I still see him, you know, from time mm-hmm. to time. And he's, you know, always like, I haven't seen you in a long time. I miss you. How have you been? And I just can't believe that I almost passed on somebody as cool as him. Mm-hmm. And so it's just one of those situations where you look at paper and you can read something about somebody and have an idea of who you think they are. And then you meet them in person and you're like, wow, like, those were just words on paper, and you just need people who believe in you. Like, mm-hmm. you need something more than you've ever been offered before. And we were able to do that. So,
and knowing that individual, like, you found his placement on day one mm-hmm. and he's been there ever since. And yeah. so, just as much as you had to give him a chance, like, that host home had to be willing mm-hmm. to take a chance and to trust you that mm-hmm. they had worked with you long enough that, he deserved a chance. And mm-hmm. I mean, he's been super successful, yeah. in that home and in the program ever since.
And I would hope that we have him forever. And if in a couple years he needs to move on, I will never feel sad for taking a chance on him. Mm-hmm. So he's a pretty cool guy, and we have, you know, 50 others that are just as cool as he is that have unique stories. But his is just the craziness of just walking in there and saying, all right, get in the car, let's go. Mm-hmm. You have yeah. your bags? And yeah. he did. We left.
Which I think speaks to just the uncertainty of mm-hmm. placements. Is every day looks different. You know, one day could be that you're working through the referrals and setting up meet and greets and going to visit them. And then the next day, you're there and you're making phone calls to mm-hmm. put all his belongings in your car and drive him, you know, to ultimately at least his home at this point for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the placement department of Restoring Hope, if you need a structured schedule of 9 to 5, it's not the department for you because, mm-hmm. you know, there's days that I wake up and I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to Kansas City today and I'll go load up the car and go. And I love that. It works great for me. And, you know, for the things that I enjoy about my job, but it may not be, you know, for everybody.
Yeah.
But I love it. I love the adrenaline, the adventure. Placements are completely an adventure. Mm-hmm. Every day it's an adventure. Every time we get a referral, it's an adventure. Some adventures, most of the adventures are definitely worth taking the risk on.
Mm-hmm. So. And I think that, like you said, the risk, there's always the unknowns with placement, mm-hmm. Because the individuals are, they need services for a reason. And mm-hmm. so they're coming to us with, like you said, tools that they've used historically, things that have happened to them. So with kind of knowing that, what are those factors that really through the placement process eliminate them from being a good fit to the level of care that a host home is able to provide?
So one of the biggest things that I look for, and I know the other members of our placement team look at, is do they want to be mm-hmm. in a host home? Because ultimately, if they don't want to be in a host home and they don't want a family, then we're setting them up for failure.
Sure.
So that's usually one of the biggest things I look for, especially in adults that we mm-hmm. support and older teens, is do they want this? If they want it, then they'll work through some of those challenging days because they want to be with a family. But aside from that, you know, because we have a lot of clients that can't necessarily verbalize those things. It would be, you know, levels of like aggression. And there's different types of aggression, mm-hmm. you know, like, and that's why meeting people in person is really important because they might be labeled as aggressive, but it could be they swat at your hand as versus headbanging or, you know, things like that. So we really just kind of look at it as, look at it at the level of which that takes place. Perping behaviors, that would be something too, that would be something we would look at. A huge percentage of the people we support have had, you know, forms of physical trauma and physical abuse. So in that, you know, sexual in nature as well, and making sure that we have homes that are equipped to deal with that. But like we had mentioned earlier, like there's times that we don't know the whole story.
Right.
And so we might be seeing some behaviors that are being displayed that we're like, whoa, like where did that come from? And, you know, try to solve that mystery. But I think that we've done a really good job over the years being able to identify red flags that would make somebody not super successful in a host mm-hmm. home. And also being giving ourselves grace when we don't know those things before we get into it. Or knowing that humans have free will and they can always change their mind. They can always display behaviors that were never recorded because we're humans. So mm-hmm. There's not a perfect checklist where we can say, oh, they hit, you know, 5 boxes, they're perfect for a host home, but we can narrow it down pretty close to whether or not they are safe to be in a home. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, ultimately what we want is we want clients who are safe.
With some of our families that we have at Restoring Hope, veteran homes and new homes, we think we know we have the right fit. So what does it look like when we go through the placement process, we think we've found the right fit, and then a few days in, we're not feeling like it's a good fit? What mm-hmm. happens then?
So we try to make sure that we have more than one option for the clients that we support. That can be kind of frustrating for our homes when they're waiting for a placement because they're like, well, I went and met them and they didn't pick me. And, you know, there is that, you know, the upfront work that goes into it to not be picked, but that's for a reason because we want them to be, long-term mm-hmm. in a home. But we don't always get it right. And sometimes what we think will work doesn't work. And I feel like I always say, like with placements, like we're not playing checkers, we're playing chess. Like we're trying to figure out all the dynamics that we can put together to make somebody successful. And you know, just like not every client is perfect for the host home model, it may just be that not every client is perfect for, you know, that particular home. So, especially with some of our seasoned homes that have supported a lot of different individuals, mm-hmm. they can get very frustrated if they get a client that isn't a good fit for them. And it says nothing negative about that home and nothing negative about that client. It just says that we need to look at a different home, and that's completely okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good point as far as, it really is finding that best possible mm-hmm. match. I know, years ago, I think of a girl that we still support, and we went through the placement process, and she had three homes, and she had the capability, and her team really wanted to give her the control, mm-hmm. To decide where her placement was going to be, which is so amazing when a team can do that, because it really gives that individual the buy-in and the control to make mm-hmm. the decision that works best for them. And just like us, like they can make the wrong decision too, but at least they had investment in it because they had the ability to do it. And on my side of it, on the placement side, I thought this one home was a for sure shoe-in, mm-hmm. like they were going to be who she picked. And she went through all of the pre-placement visits. I met with her and the team after, and she didn't pick the home that I had mm-hmm. that I thought she was going to pick. And I asked for the feedback. I'm like, you know, why did you pick this home that you picked, which was a great option? It just wasn't the option that I felt like she was going to pick. And mm-hmm. she said the home that I thought she was going to pick, she said, they're too perfect. She said, I grew up in a home that it was okay for you to wear your shoes and mm-hmm. to leave your dirty clothes on the floor and to not eat at the dinner table. And those things were important to her because that's what she felt like home was. Mm-hmm. For me, I thought she was going to pick the other home, and it was what she thought was too perfect. There wasn't mm-hmm. dirty clothes on the floor. It didn't feel lived in. And so her comfort level looked different than what I thought her comfort level was. And so she was able to articulate that, which I felt like was so great for her to be able to do that. But it also gave us insight into what they're expecting and what they want in a home is going to be different mm-hmm. because their experiences are different than ours. So, and I know you have hundreds of examples just like that to, you know, be able to share. Earlier you mentioned, you know, the individual that kind of was an emergency type situation. You decided, you know, on paper, things didn't look good, but you're willing to give them mm-hmm. a chance. When we receive that paperwork, what weight do you put in to that paperwork that we receive?
So I definitely look it over. I do want to see some historical information. There's typically like a timeline, you know, in mm-hmm. the plans. But the thing is, a plan is only as good as the person who wrote the plan. So, you know, we can have a plan that is you couldn't read anything more perfect to describe an individual. It might as well be their autobiography. You know, that's how good it is. And then we have some plans where, you know, it's missing information. Like we don't know anything. So I take stock in it in the sense that like, I do want to see what's in there. Mm-hmm. I think things that are important to know are like medical emergencies, like if they self-harming behaviors, you know, things like that, that will be listed in a plan. If there's a behavior section, if they've filled that part out, like a behavior plan, obviously like that's super important to read because those things are pretty detailed. But for the most part, if it's a standard ISP, I take a lot more stock into the conversation I have over the phone with the support coordinator mm-hmm. or with the guardian, or that time that I lay eyes on that client and I ask them to tell me what makes them awesome, because that's the first thing I do. I sit down, I say, hi, I'm Amber with Restoring Hope. Do you know why I'm here? Tell me why you're awesome. And then they get to sit there and tell me all the things about them that is not listed in an ISP.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you're right. Those plans are only as good as the person writing it and also the person giving feedback. So we mm-hmm. have a lot of individuals that are removed from homes because of abuse and neglect. And so the individuals that may have been the reporter for that were ultimately in settings that were abusive or neglectful. And so I think it's really important when we get that information to sort through who was providing that information, mm-hmm. Because it may not be accurate based on them in a setting that is set up for success and support. Mm-hmm. So I think that especially on those ones that have been removed, there was a reason why they were mm-hmm. removed.
And perception is reality. Like if you're the person who's reporting that information, you know, it's your perception of events. It's your perception of them in, you know, whatever setting it is that you've known them. And then you're relaying that information. And we want it to all be facts, obviously, like mm-hmm. it should all be documented facts. But, you know, we're receiving those facts from individuals with their own perception of the situation. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's always keeping that in mind.
Okay, so if I'm a family that is interested in signing up to become a host home and ultimately a caregiver for Restoring Hope, what do you offer them? What advice do you give to have them take that leap?
I think the first thing would be to know the intentions of it. Like, is your intention that you want to be able to stay home with your children? And so now you can, you know, work from home supporting, you know, somebody else in the home and get to be a stay-at-home mom. Is it your intention? Maybe you were in foster care mm-hmm. and now you want to give back, which that happened. We have several host homes that, you know, were in the system themselves and they're giving back. I think that that's why you're here. Is very important. But ultimately, if you're here for the right reasons, we can teach you how to do all of the other stuff. And I don't think that it does not go unnoticed by Restoring Hope's management team that, yeah, we're out there, you know, changing lives every single day. Like that's essentially our job. Like we mm-hmm. have the coolest jobs ever, but we're changing families' lives too, mm-hmm. because this might be the best job that a home has ever had. And you get to work from home doing this big, giant work that blows the minds of people who aren't in this field of what we're really doing. And you get to be a part of that. And, you know, you didn't go to college and you're having direct impact on lives. And so I know that we talk a lot about the lives that we've changed for those individuals we support, but we've changed lives of families, too. And, that's something that I think about a lot. And I think about homes, like you had mentioned earlier about, you know, the clients, you know, not necessarily wanting perfection. And there's been so many times that, you know, we've given off options of homes and it might be, you know, this big, beautiful, fancy home in a gated community. And they pick the home that is, you know, out in the country and they have chickens and ducks and, mm-hmm. you know, it's a completely different lifestyle. And, you know, those families get to do the same kind of work and our clients are looking for real people and real families and it looks lots of different ways. And I think that that's one of my favorite parts of my job is, you know, the clients obviously, but seeing these homes that, you know, they've got to change, they get to go on trips, they get to buy new homes. We've had mm-hmm. host homes able to build a new home and have, you know, with their client in mind, their own special bedroom. And like, they just, their lives are better too. And, you know, we want to enrich the lives of our individuals, but here we are enriching the lives of these families. And I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a great point. And, probably a point we don't talk about near as often as, mm-hmm. you know, the lives that we can change on the client side of things.
Yeah. And we have that connection to our clients and at the end of the day, we're responsible for them. But I think it's really neat that, you know, I have a dozen host homes I could reach out to right now and just be like, you know, hey, my dog is at the vet. I can't get back in time. Will you pick them up? Like that they're our family mm-hmm. too. And, you know, I have one host home that makes all the cupcakes for my kids' events and another host home that, you know, sends us pictures of her dog because she knows that my child likes labs. And, you know, I just think that it's, we provide family to these clients, but we're also just one big family ourselves. And, mm-hmm. I think it's neat. I think anybody that has been with Restoring Hope for any amount of time has built a network around themselves of people who are like-minded. And that's, you know, when we're outside of Restoring Hope and we tell people what we do for a living, they're kind of like, what is that? You know, but in Restoring Hope, like we're all doing the same thing mm-hmm. and we all have the same purpose and the same agenda. And it's it's amazing. And we definitely see that with our conferences and our community events and things mm-hmm. that we do, and getting to see all of these people from all different walks of life who are all living a better version of their life because they're a part of this. And it's changed my life. It's changed homes' lives. It changes clients' lives. And I think that's pretty special.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you hit it when you said purpose. And just as a society, and there's statistics out there as far as people want to do a job with purpose. Mm-hmm. And we talk about it frequently, you know, within our management meetings, how that's so easy to check that box within Restoring Hope. Mm-hmm. We don't have to focus on the purpose because our individuals, our families, all of our lives, the purpose is we get to change people's lives every single day. And mm-hmm. We don't have to look to create that. You know, it's our mission. It's everything that we do within the organization.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's neat when you look at the reason why our clients have come to us, and it's because of a broken relationship in some aspect, whether it's abuse, neglect, or, you know, a family that has fallen apart in some aspect. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that heals trauma is relationship. And so we're taking them from a broken relationship and giving them a healthy relationship and literally healing brains. And I think that, you know, all of that kind of gets overlooked for the day-to-day, you know, day-to-day checking the boxes. And did I document in therapy? You know, yeah, you documented in therapy, but you also are healing somebody's brain. Like, you are a superhero. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, we lose sight of that sometimes, especially during times of survey when it's all about checking those boxes. Yep. And in all reality, we're doing something so much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is easy to lose sight of, especially when, you know, auditors are coming in, coordinators, guardians, whoever those people are, that their roles are more focused on that paperwork. It can be really easy to be frustrated with that piece of it. And again, it's an important piece of it. But ultimately, we get to change the lives of individuals and change the trajectory of their entire life. Mm-hmm. We just know that the paperwork is a piece that goes along mm-hmm. along with that.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so just to close, I know, just from doing placements originally when I started at Restoring Hope.
Yeah, you didn't touch on that you were the original placement coordinator.
Yes. So in placements, like when I started at Restoring Hope, we really needed to evolve to that next step of putting some systems and processes in place. So I took that on from Chuck, one of the owners, and then obviously handed it off to you and the team very quickly. And you guys have made it, you know, bigger and better than ever. I know when I think of placements, my brain instantly goes to the first person I met when I was doing placements. Mm-hmm. And my thought process, I remember walking into a residential. Of course, it was a young teen boy. I did not feel equipped to be making this big, big decision for what his life was going to look like. Give me your story of the first placement that you did at Restoring Hope.
So the first one that I think I did mostly independent, because mm-hmm. I have to say, like, I did definitely was under your wing for a little bit of time. But the first one that I remember doing independently was an emergency placement for a sibling set of three little boys mm-hmm. in our Springfield area. And it was kind of shocking because it was the youngest client, I think, that we'd gotten a referral for.
At the time, yeah.
Yeah, see, he was not quite three. And their story was, I didn't think it was real. Like, I thought that things like that were stories like that were for TV. That's Dateline, that's 2020. But, you know, these boys were left at home and mom dropped food off on Thursdays. And that was the interaction they had with an adult. And they were 2, 4, and 6. And I walked into the CD office and I saw the older two boys, and the little one was hiding underneath a little toy slide. And I got on my belly and I laid down there and I kind of put my head to the side and I looked at him, and I just knew in that moment, like, he's got to have a family. Mm-hmm. So he kind of changed, that little face kind of changed my life. And I knew what we were doing was really important, but like seeing him, you realize how important that really is. And, you know, they are a success story. The three of them got, you know, the services they needed. They got the family they needed and they were adopted. So they're not even with us anymore. And those adoptions and reunifications are the, you know, it stinks to lose them. But if we lost every single one like that, then we're doing the right work. So.
Right. Right. And just knowing those three boys and obviously mm-hmm. the family that ultimately adopted them. You're right. Like in the placement world, you get a front row seat to the worst stories. Mm-hmm. And I remember that story along with, you know, a dozen other stories that you instantly think like, this is what's going on in the world we live in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like we don't necessarily think of it as it's in our communities, it's mm-hmm. in our state. And the reality is it's everywhere.
It's in our backyard. Yeah. And that's the part that I think a lot of people can't wrap their mind around is that, you know, we see these stories on the news and, you know, no one will ever know that that's who it is. But that kid that was removed from that parent that did that, you know, they're in a host home right now. Mm-hmm. And, it puts perspective on a lot of things. A lot of us live in our little bubbles, and I think that the supports that we provide to the people we provide is so big picture. It doesn't just happen in New York. It doesn't happen just in LA. It's happening in Benton County, Missouri. Like, it's happening right here in your backyard. And I think that until people are all aware of it, it goes unnoticed. Mm-hmm. But I think we're doing a really good job of Restoring Hope is doing a great job of making the communities very aware that, you know, these people are here and they deserve to be in the community and they deserve a purposeful, meaningful life. And that's what we're doing every single day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Amber, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I appreciate the time. And I know that placement worlds are busy right now.
Yes.
And family onboarding process is really busy. So I appreciate you taking the time and sitting down with me.
Yeah. Thank you.